You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of The Angle of Suspense by Christine Madrid French. The pioneering decision to feature a modern house as the villain's lair in North by Northwest arose from both the practical needs of the script and the desire to explore innovation in architectural representation. And in the photo, Frank Lloyd Wright's modern masterpiece, Falling Water, inspired Hitchcock and informed the designs for North by Northwest. The building had to frame key story elements while visually articulating the villain's character. Boyle's sketches for the overall look of the Van Damme house demonstrate a well-developed modernist sensibility with an emphasis on horizontality and an intimate relationship between the building and the natural site. The house is created from stone, wood, and glass, much like the nearby visitor center at the Mount Rushmore National Monument. The house plan is asymmetrical and accented by a series of interpenetrating roof planes. The entryway is formal, rectilinear, and enclosed, whereas the interior living area is expansive and transparent, contained in a glass box, balanced on structural beams over the valley below. This combination of spaces is in line with the physical sensation of compression and release articulated by Wright. In his work, he promoted designs that pushed people through an entryway to heighten the effect of entering the larger volumes of the living area. Even on film, this feeling of architectural movement translates to the audience. In fact, inspiration for the style and form of the Van Damme house traces directly back to the work of Wright, one of the most accomplished and popular American architects of the 20th century. Boyle and Hitchcock both referred to Wright's work as the design prototype for the house, and screenwriter Ernest Lehman confirmed this architectural legacy, describing it in the script as a sprawling modern structure in the Frank Lloyd Wright tradition, set on a rise in the land at the end of a long driveway. In an interview with fellow filmmaker Truffaut, Hitchcock mentioned that the building was a miniature of a house by Frank Lloyd Wright that's shown from a distance. A popular anecdote holds that Hitchcock first inquired with Wright about designing the fictional house, but the director could not afford the master architect's cost of design and construction. The Van Damme house is clearly inspired by Wright's iconic Falling Water, best known for its astonishing projected porches cantilevered over a running stream. Designed in 1935 for businessman and philanthropist Edgar J. Kaufman and his wife Lillian, the Pennsylvania house revolutionized American domestic architecture by combining a modernist approach, no applied decoration, and a display of technical prowess with other Wrightian conventions, such as the amalgamation of natural materials with man-made structural elements and a liberal interpretation of traditional symbols of home, such as the fireplace. The pivotal scene of North by Northwest called for voyeuristic windows and thrusting support beams, features primarily found in high-end modernist residences. Boyle dismissed the notion of identifying an existing building for filming. "This was not a house we could find in the field," he observed. Using Falling Water as the inspiration, Boyle created a sophisticated lair that emerged boldly from the rugged landscape. As for the cantilevered beams, Boyle noted that he really jutted it out and rendered the house more extravagant than its real-life exemplar to provide a kind of jungle gym for Cary Grant. In North by Northwest, the modernist design effectively merged the malevolent identities of the structure and the villain. Film critics such as Raymond Ergnat interpreted the Van Damme house as a sentient being. He described the building as an alien, malign, disaffected intelligence. Likewise, he interpreted the position of the home on a plateau above the carved stone faces of Mount Rushmore as one that expresses visual domination and panoptic control over the nearby devotional shrine of American democracy. Author Stephen Jacobs, who created a set of blueprints of the house based on extensive archival research, observed that both love of the arts and a predilection for modern architecture are persistent Hollywood signifiers of menace and malice. Jacobs conflated the style and location of the building with the power of the villain within. He posited that this iconic residence ultimately represented a progressive quest for power and wealth, a quality attributed to capitalists and likewise to criminals. Current Vanity Fair architectural critic Paul Goldberger agreed, writing that the Van Damme House's very existence suggests tension and improbability. Goldberger linked modernism and villainy in his observation that the stark modernity of the structure, and indeed the fact that it is itself so visibly a work of structure, underscores a sense of modern architecture as thrilling, dangerous, and exotic. The powerful design of the house not only changed architectural interpretations in film, but affirmed the logic of the North by Northwest narrative that ultimately exposed Van Damme as a cold-blooded and deceitful killer. Goldberger believed that this climactic reveal would have not been the same had the mountaintop contained a rustic cabin instead of this modernist extravaganza. In the decades following the release of North by Northwest, filmmakers enthusiastically adopted Hitchcock's architectural precedent, crafting fictional modernist structures and rediscovering designs in Southern California that could host a score of film villains introduced in the 1960s and 70s. Architect John Lautner designed many houses during this period that later found fame as villains' lairs. His tactile, sensuously curved concrete spaces exude power in their boldness and unorthodox approach. Filming creators also appreciated the cinematic scale and the ambitiousness and improbability of the designs. Ken Adam, production designer for the James Bond series of films, including Dr. No, Goldfinger, Thunderball, The Spy Who Loved Me, and Moonraker, featured the Lautner-designed Arthur Elrod House in Palm Springs in Diamonds Are Forever. Bond, played with finesse by Sean Connery, tracked billionaire Willard White to his lair in the hills, protected by the acrobatic Bambi and Thumper. The women swing from the modern lighting, leap from the living room boulders, and attempt to drown Bond in the sky-high swimming pool. The perfect hideaway for a villain. Director Brian De Palma selected the Chemisphere, another cliff-hanging Lautner design, for Body Double, a murderous homage to both Vertigo and Rear Window. The film and the building draw upon prevailing narratives of voyeurism, identity, and complicit shame explored by Hitchcock. Jeanine Upwall, an Academy Award-nominated production designer for L.A. Confidential, featuring the Richard Neutra-designed Lovell House in its own villainous star turn, noted that in her line of work, the best architecture goes to the film's worst characters. Hitchcock manipulated our collective memory and the language of building design to create constructed expressions of human emotions, including love, envy, and the killer instinct. He was driven by an intense engagement with location and architectural form, picturing buildings not only as scenic devices, but as interactive participants. For Hitchcock, the parts of a structure represent humanity and all its complications. Windows are the eyes into the soul. A stairway is a spine between the heart and mind, and a door permits entry into subliminal perceptions. His buildings, including the maternal Victorian mansion and naughty motel along the old highway in Psycho, the honeycomb of Greenwich Village apartments in Rear Window, the avian-infested Bodega Bay schoolhouse in The Birds, and the deadly skyscrapers and towers of Vertigo, illuminate the uncertain relationships we hold inside our own minds with the built world around us and between each other. This article was adapted and excerpted from The Architecture of Suspense, The Built World in the Films of Alfred Hitchcock by Christine Madrid French, published by UVA Press, 2022.
Thank you.
kindred spirits. Decades after Samuel L. Jackson originated a role in August Wilson's turbulent family drama, The Piano Lesson, he's headed to Broadway with John David Washington to bring a ghost story back to life by Tony Norman. With photos by Peter Hapak, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. Opening photos, piano players, Samuel L. Jackson and John David Washington, photographed in New York City on June 29th. I was around when August would come and lay out 8 pages of a new speech that we had to put in that night because we were doing previews. And you run and you do it, says Samuel L. Jackson. He's thinking back to 1987, when he originated the role of Boy Willie in August Wilson's play The Piano Lesson at the Yale Repertory Theater. He regards the late playwright as the Black Shakespeare, but says, man, it was a lot of words. It was grueling. This fall, John David Washington plays Boy Willie in a Broadway revival directed by Jackson's wife of 42 years, LaTanya Richardson Jackson. And because Jackson himself will appear as Boy Willie's uncle, Doker Charles, he'll do it while standing on stage with the man who first gave the character flesh and blood. I'm coming in as a student, Washington says in a dual interview with his co-star. I'm coming in to learn as much as I can from our director, LaTanya, and this man here. Washington has known Jackson since the former was a toddler, thanks to Jackson's friendship with his father, Denzel. Still, it sounds like it'd be intimidating to recreate the role right in front of him. Jackson waves the idea away. He didn't see me do it, he says, then adds playfully, but I killed that shit. Washington laughs, and the ghost, like in the theme of the play, will forever haunt us. The Piano Lesson, which won Wilson his second Pulitzer Prize for drama in 1990, takes place in the Charles household in Pittsburgh in 1936, as Boy Willie and his sister Bernice, Danielle Brooks, battle over the fate of the family's prized piano and contend with the good and evil spirits it conjures. Boy Willie is an impetuous striver, eager to grab his piece of the American dream, even if it means aggravating an already tempestuous relationship with his sister. He wants to sell the piano to buy land in Mississippi that their family toiled on for decades as sharecroppers and to start building some generational wealth. Bernice wants to keep the piano as a testament to their tragic history. It is, after all, carved with images of their ancestors. Doker, who makes several of the play's key speeches, wants the most elusive thing of all, peace. Boy Willie and Bernice's struggle over the piano summons the ghost of a dead landowner named Sutter, who terrorized the family in the South. The malevolent spirit could be a stand-in for slavery, Jim Crow, white supremacy, or all of the above. And it's this force that Richardson Jackson is most interested in wrangling with on Broadway. Let's amplify this part of it, she tells me, flashing the most contagious smile you'll ever see. Let's look at this effing ghost. Why is Sutter there? What does Sutter want? Why are we still talking about Sutter? We keep conjuring the ghost, but we don't deal with it. We're going to have to deal with it, and we're going to deal with it in this one. Richardson Jackson has revered the piano lesson ever since she saw her husband play Boy Willie at Yale Rep. You can mess around and put different clothes on it, but you have to leave that language alone, because what he's written is sacrosanct to me, says the director, who was nominated for a 2014 Tony for Best Actress for Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun, and later played Calpurnia in Aaron Sorkin's adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird. I'm quick to tell everyone, August Wilson didn't create the language, but he was able to capture it better than anyone that I have ever read or seen. He writes it, and I hear my grandparents. Wilson's dialogue, she says, reminds her of her grandfather going off to play checkers and talk smack. Wilson's monumental tin play, Pittsburgh Cycle, of which the piano lesson is a part, captures the joys and undeniable challenges of black life in earthy, colloquial, poetic, mysterious language that both reveals and obscures the intentions of the main characters. When I ask Richardson Jackson if she plans to reimagine any of the parts in the piano lesson, as Sorkin did when he amped up Calpurnia's role in Mockingbird, she says, "The way August wrote Bernice, she's dynamic already. She's already ahead of the game. And with the embodiment of Danielle Brooks, it's going to the next level. With the exception of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which features two major white characters and takes place in Chicago, the Pittsburgh Cycle plays center exclusively on the black experience in Pittsburgh over the course of 100 years. White folks are referred to in passing and exist only offstage. Pittsburgh's Hill District, a predominantly black working-class neighborhood that fell on bleak times with deindustrialization, is every bit a character in the plays, and references to real streets and institutions flow freely. As a newspaper journalist in Pittsburgh, I've known plenty of black literary folks who claimed to have inspired characters in Wilson plays. The truth is that the city got around to fully embracing his work only after he left and won acclaim elsewhere. His appearances in Pittsburgh were well attended, but marked by an ironic, somewhat bitter undertone that seemed to translate to, 'You had a chance to love me first, but you didn't take it. How do you like me now?' I got to meet and talk with Wilson on two occasions before his death in 2005. In the 90s, he gave a short speech at the Homewood Public Library, then mingled with community leaders and fans. I approached him when he was standing alone and eating a piece of cake on a small paper plate. He was a soft-spoken man whose shyness was evident immediately. I was grateful that his eyes didn't glaze over when I told him how much I loved the few plays of his that I had been able to see up to that point. Wilson perked up when I told him I was a feature writer at the local newspaper and a participant in the Kuntu Writers Workshop, a group he started with playwright-poet Rob Penny in 1976. He spoke about the workshop's mission, saying it was important for black writers to have a space to share work and receive critical feedback in a loving environment. Soon, some local mucky-mucks horned in on our conversation and pulled him away for pictures. I was left with the impression of a firm handshake and encouragement to keep writing, no matter what. Though Wilson seemed reserved in person, he and his longtime collaborator, the director Lloyd Richards, were demanding when it came to perfecting the plays. Jackson tells Washington and me that part of his regimen for playing Boy Willie was being hung upside down so he'd have the stamina to speak at the top of his lungs for 3 hours. The piano lesson first hit Broadway in 1990, but Jackson was not yet enough of a star to play the role he'd helped bring to life. Charles S. Dutton took over as Boy Willie and drew a Tony nomination. Jackson was relegated to the wings. "I never went on when I was an understudy," says the actor, who has said he was a high-functioning crack addict at the time. "I kind of lost my mind. I went to rehab because of it." At the time of our interview, rehearsals for the revival at the Ethel Barrymore Theater haven't yet begun, and Jackson is still reacquainting himself with the text of the piano lesson. "He has found himself in the company of ghosts," he tells me. "Not just Sutters, but the whole cast from Yale Rep. It's sometimes daunting," he says, "and it's fun only because I hear all the people I did the play with. I hear myself being Boy Willie. Doker carries his own weight, his own water, in a whole nother kind of way." When Washington says he plans to learn from Jackson, his mentor interrupts, and says of his wife and director, "She's already told you that you can't talk to me." Both men laugh. "I can still learn by example," Washington says, adding that he can relate to the tension between Boy Willie and Bernice in the play's exploration of the different meanings of inheritance. As for Richardson Jackson, she says she cried while observing the photo shoot for this story. "I'm watching John David Washington, and he's a star now," she says. "I'm about to have the opportunity to work on a tremendous piece with people whose hands I've held for a long time. Danielle, I've known her since she was young, and of course, Sam, whom I've known 50-something years. These are people I know." Richardson Jackson will be the first woman to direct an August Wilson play on Broadway. She's never directed on Broadway at all. But then, how many black women have had the chance? "There are a lot of us in regional theater that no one knows about," she says. "The dominant culture has had a lot of time to practice, and they practice in the A space. So Broadway is it. They practice here. I don't have a lot of time to practice or to be nervous about Broadway or Ghost." cut and polish. Born into fashion royalty, Delfina della Trasfendi debuts the first ever haute jewelry line for the Italian house bearing her name by Leah Fay Cooper, with photographs by Hendrik Kerstens. Opening photo, Delfina della Trasfendi, photographed at Palazzo della Civiltà Italiano, the Fendi headquarters, in July 2022. The scene at Paris's Palais Brongniart on a gleaming July afternoon is busy but not chaotic, organized but not rigid. The palatial neoclassical building, which once housed the Paris Stock Exchange, is being transformed for Fendi's fall-winter 2022 Haute Couture show. In the days leading up to it, they've been using the space as an office and atelier. The lobby is reserved for staffers dressed in black, checking in models and members of the show's production team, and granting them all building access with Fendi emblazoned wristbands. In one sprawling room with wood floors and vaulted ceilings, Silvia Venturini Fendi, whose grandparents Adele and Edoardo founded the Italian house in 1925, and who currently serves as artistic director of menswear, accessories, and children, sits behind a table next to Kim Jones, artistic director of Fendi's couture and women's collections. Shelves of crystal embellished shoes line one wall. Racks of couture garments are planted along another. From behind the table, which is covered with papers, photos, and several Fendi bags, Silvia and Jones watch models walk about the room, examining the fit of the pieces they're wearing. If you didn't know the secret Fendi has been keeping for the past year, you'd assume one of the hand-beaded gowns was the collection's pièce de résistance. But down a long hallway, in a much smaller, much more discreet room, there's something else. There, Delfina della Trasfendi stands next to a desk examining a trio of white and yellow diamond pieces, each on a pale gray leather tray. "I wanted these pieces to be meaningful and evocative," Delfina tells me. "There's nothing more evocative than diamonds, and there is nothing more meaningful at Fendi than yellow." One of Silvia's three children, Delfina is a Rome-based jewelry designer who helms an eponymous brand. In 2020, she became Fendi's artistic director of jewelry. The pieces she's showing me, her latest designs, comprise the house's first ever high jewelry collection. Tomorrow, Fendi will formally enter the haute jewelry market when they're presented on the couture runway. The collection includes a symmetrical pointed necklace, a wash in more than 1,000 diamonds, a cascading pair of earrings, and a multiband cocktail ring. They are extravagant. They are meticulously crafted. They are definitely price upon request. Emanating an otherworldly sparkle, each features Fendi's signature FF logo, fashioned with yellow diamond baguettes. Delfina spent months working with a certified supplier before choosing the vibrant, ethically sourced stones from Zimi Sierra Leone. It's the only place where you can find these very saturated yellow diamonds with this incredibly intense color, she says, likening the hue to a Roman sunset. Stare at the necklace long enough, and you'll notice a handful of the white diamonds arranged into more subtle Fs. "I wanted to work with the logo, but in a softer way," Delfina explains. "By doing this kind of geometric assemblage, we created the logo as if it were a sort of hidden code, a hidden message." Delfina began designing the collection more than a year ago in what she describes as an organic evolution of the brand. "Jewelry," she says, "is becoming more important to Fendi, and these pieces mark the beginning of a new long chapter for the house." The collection was made in Paris, and when it debuts at the show, she wants it to speak to the contrast the house is known for. I would totally imagine this necklace with a pair of jeans and a t-shirt, she says. I follow her back to the fitting, where her mother and Jones are still dissecting the collection. She's wearing a beige stand collar wool jacket and a slim-cut chiffon dress in white and mint green, both Fendi. Black mules add about 2 inches to her 5-foot frame, and her brown hair is cut chin length, side parted, and tucked behind her ears. The polished look matches the 34-year-old's confident, composed demeanor and is accented with shimmery turquoise eyeliner. Unsurprisingly, there isn't a jeans and t-shirt look to pair the high jewelry with, so Delfina, Sylvia, and Jones gather in front of a board with each model pictured in the order they'll appear on the runway and decide how to style and present it. Palato Jesper Michael will open the show wearing a Vicuña wool blazer. Matching wide leg trousers and the high jewelry necklace. The three discuss seemingly small but rather significant details. Should the model wear a shirt under the blazer? No, the necklace is far more prominent against bare skin. Should the blazer be buttoned or opened? Definitely opened. There are gloves that go with the suit, but should they ditch those in favor of her wearing the ring instead? Or maybe the ring can go over the gloves. Neither. She'll wear the gloves, no ring. The necklace will be the only high jewelry piece to go down the runway, but as is customary with haute jewelry, the full collection will be shown later to editors and VIP clients during private appointments. About face, next photos. Illusions and surrealism live at the core of these pieces, an ear cuff and profile brooch from Delfina's eponymous label. And Delfina, with her grandmother, Anna Fendi, and her mother, Sylvia Venturini Fendi, sits front row at the Valentino Haute Couture Fall-Winter 2022 show in Rome. The following afternoon, Delfina is back at Palais Brongniart. The show has just finished, and the backstage bustle has begun to quell following a rush of editors, celebrities, and photogs ushered in to congratulate Jones. Fendi Worldwide Private Client Relations Director Gabriele Moncade di Paterno arranges a photo op for friends of the house, Steve and Marjorie Harvey. And as Winnie Harlow joins the three for a picture, a post-show press release lands in scores of fashion industry inboxes extolling Fendi's debut high jewelry designs. For all the pomp and circumstance that's happening a level below her, though, Delfina is decidedly calm. She has a few minutes to spare before gathering with her family and the Fendi team to watch a playback of the show, a long-standing tradition. Today, she's in a version of the flowy pink sleeveless dress that just appeared on the runway. "When I was a child, my mom never allowed me to wear pink," she tells me. "I was always wearing brown, gray, blue, black. So now, every time I wear pink, I feel like I'm doing something wrong." Looking back, she wonders if the rule began with her great-grandmother Adele. Maybe for my great-grandmother, it was a way to prepare her 5 daughters for a world that was changing, but still a world that was male-oriented. It was a way to find their space and their voice in a world that was led by men. One of those daughters, Anna, is Sylvia's mother and Delfina's grandmother. Next photos, carved in stone. An artisan details the inverted FF logo in an illustration of the Fendi Flavus necklace. The Fendi Flavus earrings and necklace from the brand's first ever high jewelry collection feature white and yellow diamonds. "Growing up with Fendi was fantastic," Delfina says. "You have the pros and the cons, okay? We have to be honest. But it was fantastic. We are a very united family." Every Sunday, throughout her childhood and teens, the Fendis would gather for lunch and inevitably end up talking about work because this is what happens when you work in the family, she says. These lunches, she continues, were very democratic. They weren't asking us children to step out of the room. They were allowing us to hear, to observe, to learn, and also to participate, with the only rule, which was to have a point of view, to have something to say. At 18, Delfina entered Italian drama school, Accademia Silvio D'Amico, to study costume design. They were the most intense 6 months of my life, she says. Though she didn't have a passion for being on stage, she was required to study acting. Being pushed out of her comfort zone was like doing therapy every day, but it was also physically taxing. So much so that when at 19 she found out she was expecting her first child, she had to leave. Still, the experience was enriching in that it affirmed her ambitions were genuine. It really made me understand that I wanted to go back home. Home being fashion, but specifically jewelry design, which she found herself drawn to. When I started being interested in jewelry, in wearing jewelry, every time I wore something, I felt it didn't belong to my energy, to my aesthetic, to my generation, she says. Looking to fill that sartorial void, she launched the Delfina Delatrez fashion and fine jewelry brand in 2007. I started making jewelry for many reasons, but I'm sure one of the reasons was the fact that it was, let's say, a category that wasn't touched by Fendi. So it was a way to walk with my own legs. Handmade in Rome, her range includes an anatomical collection marked by bejeweled eyes and lips, and she's among designers who helped popularize the now pervasive single statement earring trend. As her website notes, she's drawn to rendering the ordinary extraordinary. To that end, she's released gold and pearl earrings designed to encircle earbuds and a functional sterling silver ice cream cone. Every time I create something, I ask, is it worth working on 6 months? Is it new enough? Does it exist? Would I wear it? Every new piece, it's really a personal need. Some of her most ambitious designs to date, the Fendi Flavus collection, named to invoke the Latin term signifying yellow or blonde in ancient Rome, sold within hours of showing on the runway. The morning after the Fendi Couture show, at Delfina's first haute jewelry appointment, an undisclosed house client bought all three pieces. Oh, it was such an emotion, Delfina says, of presenting and selling the pieces when we speak 2 weeks later over Zoom. The satisfaction in her voice is palpable, but her tone is hushed. On a whim, Delfina and her partner of 8 years, with whom she shares 4-year-old twin sons, took a trip to a region of southern Italy. I can't speak very loudly, as I'm in an antique medieval, let's say, village, she says. I'm in Abruzzo, living as the Medicis used to live. So I'm basically living 2 days without any air conditioning, without any artificial light, and it's just beautiful. It's a stark contrast to her busy life in Rome, where she's been privy to the high-energy trappings of luxury fashion since birth. To me, at the beginning, growing up in my family looked to me very normal, she says. I started understanding that there was something extraordinary by looking at my friends' reactions, she adds, noting that her playdates often took place at the Fendi studio as opposed to her home. Of course, at that age, you don't want to be that extraordinary because you kind of feel that you want to be normal. While Delfina didn't always wear being a Fendi on her sleeve, neither figuratively nor literally, when she was seen in the double F print, friends joked that it was like she was wearing her passport. She was drawn to the incredible and eccentric personalities she was exposed to, among them Karl Lagerfeld, who joined Fendi in 1965 and served in various capacities, including artistic director, until his death in 2019. It was a very familiar presence, she says, of being in the late designer's orbit. Even now that Karl is not here with us any longer, I feel that I have this gift of, I was able to see the real Carl, see his weakness and see his vulnerable parts and his humanity, besides his strength and incredible talent. One of those talents, she says, was an encyclopedic knowledge of obscure subjects. You could talk about any topic with him. He had an answer for everything. Similarly, she absorbed much from her matriarchal family. It was as if they passed me these special double F glasses that kind of allow you to look at things from this Fendi lens, she says. I was taught that an item isn't only a beautiful item, but it's something that really nourishes you and also educates people to beauty. And beauty calls more beauty. I was taught that garments and objects can represent something more than just a fashion statement. Following what she describes as a Wednesday Addams phase in her preteens, Delfina slowly began to incorporate more color and Fendi into her wardrobe. The first Fendi thing that I decided to wear, she remembers, was the denim Fendi baguette, the iconic It bag designed by her mother in 1997. Around the same time, she was compelled to turn one of her mother's Lagerfeld-designed pieces into a mini dress. She arrived home, and she found me in her closet with scissors, she recalls. She came in too late, and I had already destroyed that dress. But she kind of laughed inside. I could see that she was like, okay, finally, she's there, and she's appreciating. Let's just maybe hide the scissors. Experimentation is a pillar of her work at Fendi. Prior to her artistic director appointment, she had designed accessories for the house, including a cache of pieces bedecked with fur, feathers, and crystals in 2014, and a 2016 series of fine watches inspired by Rome's Palazzo della Civiltà Italiana, which houses Fendi's headquarters. Jewelry art was always a male-oriented thing, she says. Only in the past 10 years have we had this sort of wave of new female jewelry designers. Together, we kind of changed the way that women now look, wear, and think about jewelry. Last year, Delfina introduced the Fendi Olac collection, rendering the FF logo into an oval shape with carabiner-like functionality, which allows pieces to be mixed and layered. It was an instant success, and the oval FF now adorns everything from belts and loafers to sunglasses and chokers. Working from both her brand's office and the Fendi studio, the only daily routine Delfina sticks to is waking up with her three children and getting them ready for school. Being a mother, she says, is both the hardest job of all and one that she constantly relishes. She describes her 15-year-old daughter as being like an earthquake, possessing a performative spirit that makes her far more comfortable in the spotlight than her mother is. Her sons have developed distinct personalities, too. A few weeks ago, we went to the florist to buy flowers and plants, she shares. One was like, I want to buy this flower that has all the colors of the rainbow, each petal colored and sparkling. The other was like, I want to buy a thorn. I want to buy thorns and dust. Whether or not fashion will be their calling is yet to be determined, but her wish for them is to pursue whatever they choose for themselves. I would love to imagine that my children could sort of continue what I have created, but I don't want to push, she says. Nobody really pushed us to love fashion. It's something that naturally arose in some of us and not in others, and I'm the only one from my generation to work in the company and work in this field. I think the gift that you can give to your children is the power of freedom.
Thank you.
onto books through the lens. In her new book, Annie Leibovitz showcases 5 decades of singular fashion photography by Madison Reed. Since becoming one of Vanity Fair's first contributors at its relaunch in 1983, Annie Leibovitz has helped define the look and spirit of this magazine. Wonderland, published by Phaidon, her latest monograph, is filled with an array of commissions for Vanity Fair. From the beginning, she writes, a legendary world where photographers were recognized as artists. Vogue and other publications shot between 1972 and 2021. We see supermodel Natalia Vodianova as Alice in the proverbial book title, a pregnant Serena Williams swathed in a billowing orange caftan, Nicole Kidman, circa Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, and Rihanna, glamorous beside a siren red car in the streets of Havana. Fashion has always been there, Leibovitz writes of her more than 50-year career. It is the driving force in a portrait, whether it is Jerry Garcia in a black T-shirt or Patti Smith in the much-imitated style that has endured for decades, or the Rolling Stones. Fashion plays a part in the scheme of everything, but photography always comes first for me. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.